ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
But I am so pleased to welcome Pip Williams to the Writers on Nightlife tonight. Pip's debut novel, The Dictionary of Lost Words, was a huge hit when it was published in 2020. It told the story of Esme Nicol, the daughter of one of the compilers of the Oxford English Dictionary, who sits under the table and collects the slips on which the discarded words were written. It was a huge hit. Sold more than 400,000 copies in Australia. It became the first ever Australian book to be selected for Reese Witherspoon's book club. And theatre adaptations coming later this year too. Pip did a lot of research for the book at Oxford. And while she was there, she also became fascinated by the process of binding books. And in her second novel, a companion novel to The Dictionary of Lost Words, she's taking us back to Oxford as World War I breaks out and the city becomes a place of refuge for fleeing Belgians. Her book is called The Bookbinder of Jericho. Hello, Pip. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, Suzanne. It's just lovely to be here.
I want to talk first about just how successful the Dictionary of Lost Words was. Were you expecting any of the kind of success that it's had?
Not at all. You probably already know this, but it came out about 2 days into lockdown. So the whole world had gone into lockdown. There were no bookshops open. I think the book industry thought that it was going to collapse in a heap. My expectations were really low, actually. But there were worse things happening in the world and we put it out there and something beautiful happened. People started to read it and mentioning it to friends and family. And throughout that year, I was surprised every week by the sales figures.
Yeah. So what happens when you get into Reese Witherspoon's book club? Do they give you a call and go, hey, Reese likes your book?
Yes, essentially. I think they gave my publisher a call, who then gets in touch with me. I had about a month's notice or so, and I was sworn to secrecy. And it was quite amazing because I don't think it's the sort of thing that publishers can pitch for. So it really does have to come across the path of the people in Reese Witherspoon's book club kind of administrative. There's about five people who work for the book club, and they have to just come across it, pass it on to Reese. If she loves it, then it becomes one of her books.
And then what does it mean when it's one of her books? Does she talk about it, or how did you get involved as well?
Yes. So she talks about it. They have this whole infrastructure for the book club so people can get online. They read it together chapter by chapter. People discuss it chapter by chapter. And I do a sort of book club appearance, so an event with people in the book club. So a few hundred people turned up to that event. It was online, of course. I never actually got to chat to Reese, unfortunately, but she does, she did all sorts of promotions of the book, if you like. So she reads it, she talks about it, she posts online about it. It's really phenomenal. And of course, if you have a book that's part of her book club, many more people read it than would have if you weren't part of her book club. And so on the back of that, the book went into the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh, fantastic. So you opened it up to a lot of Americans who might well never have come across it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm really glad to say it was already being read quite well in America, but this was a massive injection of readers, and, I'm incredibly grateful to have been chosen for that book club.
Yeah. The theatre production too later this year, have you had to send the book off into other people's hands and trust them completely, or do you still get some say in the way your story is told?
Well, it's really interesting. I've said to friends, it's a bit like having a child that's grown up and done something really interesting with its life, and it's gone off and met people without telling me. So my book has basically been read by people who've then talked about it and decided, wouldn't it make a great miniseries, for instance. All those discussions happened kind of without me knowing. It's like my book had turned up to a party that I didn't know it was going to. And then I finally get, they get in contact with me and some producers from South Australia, actually, which is just really wonderful, have acquired the option to turn it into a miniseries. And it's just thrilling to know that the book has this life of its own. I will be involved in the screen production as an executive producer, which is really exciting because it's a whole area, a whole industry that I know nothing about but would love to know more about. So I feel like I'll be there in a way like a parent in the wings, but I will also be learning so much about a different way of telling stories.
But just like that grown-up child, you might be able to give advice, but they might not listen to you.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And I'm really interested, as I am with the stage production, something I've said to both the playwright Verity Lawton, who's writing the stage play, and the producers Lisa Scott and Rebecca Summerton, I want them to turn this into something else. Do you know what I mean? A book is one art form, but screen and stage are different art forms. And I'm very happy for them to take it in whatever direction they think it needs to go.
Pip Williams is here, and yeah, just extraordinary success for your debut novel.
I know.
Have you put a lot of pressure on yourself then for the second to be really good?
Well, I didn't actually. It's really interesting. A lot of people are asking me this question now. I think because of COVID and because I'm not on any social media, I was a bit sheltered in the writing of the second book. I was just at home like everybody else doing my thing, which was writing the second book, which I'd started before Dictionary had come out. So I already had the idea and no pressure because I thought Dictionary would just sort of, you know, fall below the radar because of COVID. So I'd already started writing. I already had the whole story in my head before I knew Dictionary was taking off. And then because I wasn't highly engaged through social media, I was able to just write in peace. It wasn't until I was really through the first draft, almost finished the first draft, that my publisher did check in to make sure I was okay because, you know, a second book on the back of a popular first book can be very stressful. And that's the first time I thought about it. So suddenly I'm like, should I be stressed? I'm not stressed, but maybe I should be stressed. And why aren't I stressed? You know. And of course I did before the book was released. So after, you know, I'd done everything I could, the editors had done everything they could, and it was gone to print. There is this moment of sheer terror and anxiety because I can no longer really read it fresh. I can't be objective about it. And so I was relying on other people really to tell me whether they thought it was ready. I had a sense it was. I knew I loved my characters. I was happy with the structure and all those sorts of things. But I couldn't really convince myself that readers would like it. And so I was really holding my breath for the first week. Mm. And, you know, I'm completely relieved with the reception.
Yes, for what it's worth, I've got a couple of chapters to go, but I've absolutely loved it. And you have such an amazing turn of phrase. I wish I had some of them to hand, but some of the most beautiful lines and the little ideas that you express with some of the words are just amazing. So, Pip, why weren't you ready to leave the environs of Oxford in the 1910s? What was it that kept you there?
You just kind of expressed what I might have said. I wasn't ready to leave. Mm. So I'd finished Dictionary and in some ways was pining for that time and place still. It's like I never got sick of it. I kind of thought I would. I thought spending 3 years writing about the one place, the one thing, by the end of it I'd be, you know, done and dusted and want to get it out of my life. But I didn't. I still really loved being in that place and that time. And I had come across other things during my research that I couldn't write about in Dictionary, but I had started, you know, thinking about this new book while I was doing the research for Dictionary, because I came across images of women in the bindery at Oxford University Press, images of them folding the pages of books and also some film footage of women folding pages but also gathering sections. And the way they work is so graceful in a way. It's so efficient, but it's beautiful. And I wondered, do these women ever stop to read the words that are passing through their hands every single day, hours and hours of every day? And it was just a thought. It sort of just entered into my mind, but it was the seed that I needed for this new book. And so I started thinking immediately of this character who does want to read the words and is told that her job is to bind the books, not read them.
So the story has two, I mean, the main character is Peggy. There's her sister Maud. They work in the book bindery. I'd imagine that the way they were doing it, though, with this folding and this dancing doesn't happen anymore, or does it in some places? Did you find that out?
Yes, I did. It doesn't. So it's one of those crafts, one of those professions that essentially is now relegated to the realm of hobby and craft. So there are lots of people probably listening to this show who have bound a book the old-fashioned way, folding the pages, gathering the sections, sewing them together and then binding it in leather, for instance. But that rarely happens on a it doesn't happen on a commercial level anymore. And the only time it does happen to any extent now is in book repair. So really old books that need repairing are repaired pretty much the way they would have been repaired 100 years ago because they want to maintain the bindings that book might have been bound in, you know, centuries ago even. But the process of a book being made these days, you know, very few hands would touch the pages, the board, the leather of a new book these days. The first hands that touch it might be the people who unpack the book at the bookstore. It's all very automated. Whereas 100 years ago, a book might go through 20 or 30 hands and it goes through a whole lot of processes which are really sometimes quite violent. You know, books, not only are the pages folded, but they're sewn and then they're cut and then the spine is beaten with a hammer. There's so many, and then the life is squashed out of the book to get as much air out of it as possible. It's such an interesting process, and I had never thought when I picked up a book, an old book particularly, that I know was bound 50, 60, 100 years ago, I'd never thought how many hands it had gone through and how many eyes might have passed over those words and been intrigued by what they read and then not been allowed to keep reading.
When do you think it was that bookbinding in that way stopped on a commercial scale?
Well, I do know that it was still happening in the 60s and 70s here, because I had the enormous good fortune of developing a relationship with a man called Peter Zajcek from the State Library of South Australia. He's now in his 60s, I think, but he started as an apprentice bookbinder when he was 15 at the State Library. And he tells me that at that time there were about 55 people in the bindery doing exactly the processes that I describe in my book. So he was useful to me on so many levels because he could check what I was writing to make sure I was describing the processes correctly, because he's actually done them.
You had a real life bookbinder there.
Yes. Yeah. And also he could teach me by hand how to do those things so that I could describe them better. And in fact, not that long ago, he helped me to bind my own book.
Oh, wow. So you went through the entire process.
Yes, yes. It was extraordinary and, you know, incredibly special. And I'm so, so grateful to him. So I did all of those things.
Pip Williams is here. Her new book is The Bookbinder of Jericho. It's a companion book to The Dictionary of Lost Words, which was a huge hit when it was released in 2020. So what you found out, though, when you went to look at the way books had been bound, Pip, was that there was a really clear division between this bit of putting the book together is for women to do and this bit of putting the book together is for men to do. What were those divisions?
That's right. And, it's startling, even in the titles or the names of the rooms where the men and women work, there was the men's side of the bindery, and that's what it was called, and the girls' side. So they weren't even called women. And I should say that in both sides there were adolescents working as apprentices on both the men's side and the girls' side. But the majority of people working on the girls' side were women. And the women's work was to take the pages from the printing press and fold them into sections, and that could be up to 16 pages each side of on a sheet. And then those sections are gathered into a book. And then that book is sewn together, so all those sections are sewn together. And then it's all passed on to the men. And the men are the ones who use the guillotine to cut the edges straight.
They do the beating too, they
do
they?
The, that's right. They do the beating, they do the cutting, they do the covering. And then everything you see when you pick up that book, the beautiful leather cover, the embossing, the gilded words on the book, the title, all of that is done by the men. And everything that the women do gets covered up. And, you know, the metaphors are everywhere. When I started writing this book, I didn't have to try very hard to find metaphors for how women existed at that time and why we just don't know very much about the experience of being a bookbinder as a woman 100 years ago.
Well, you went looking in the Oxford University archives, I think, to see if you could find stories about the real women, but they were sorely lacking.
Yes, exactly. So I was interested in them because I was writing a scene about a book being bound in Dictionary of Lost Words, and I just wanted to get a better sense of how that might have been done. And the Oxford University Press archives are just wonderful, and the archivists there have been enormously helpful to me. They will search for anything that I'm looking for. But when I wanted to find out more about the women, there wasn't really very much that they could give me. What they could give me was some photographs of women from the 1920s, folding pages, and also this black and white film footage that I told you about, which was just part of a much longer film about the making of a book at Oxford University Press. But there are a few scenes of the women doing their work. But there were no sort of first-hand accounts of work in the bindery by the women, whereas there was a lot of that by the men. There was a beautiful journal that came out in 1919 after the war called the Clarendonian, which was an in-house journal, and it was designed really to welcome the men back from war and to help them to become part of that Jericho Oxford University Press family again, to re-establish their connection to that place. And that journal lasted for many, many years, and it's full of beautiful anecdotes about men in different parts of the press and the work that they do and reminiscing about people as they retire. But there wasn't a single story about a woman who worked on the girls' side of the bindery.
That did give you free rein to create those women though, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yeah. And of course, I had access to other information. I had access to a wonderful report that was done. It was beautiful. It was like a social science report that was published in 1913 in the United States about the experience of being a female bookbinder in that place at that time. And again, the processes were very similar across continents. And that report was, you know, very uniquely written by a female researcher, and all of her research assistants were female. So it was quite unique in lots of ways. So I leaned heavily on that. I leaned heavily on what Peter Zajac, the bookbinder I knew in South Australia, knew of his experience, because it really hadn't changed. And also just reading a lot of books of the time that told me how things were done.
I know, Pip, you see fiction as a great way to fill gaps in history, don't you?
I do. I think fiction is just such a wonderful way to explore the gaps, not just in the official history, but also the gaps that exist in archives. And like history books, archives have been kind of set up, developed and maintained by men traditionally.
Now, I was just thinking, you know, as a teenager, I read a lot of the sort of Jean Plaidy historical novels where you'd have a wife of Henry VIII and the story would be told from her perspective. And I was thinking everyone was creating those perspectives to a large degree, and that's how we heard or we could imagine those voices.
Yeah, and I think that's really valid, actually. One of the things that I've come to believe through my research for these novels, but actually also I used to be a social scientist, and my research was in sociology and psychology and public health. So through my work experience over my lifetime, I have come to believe that fundamentally humans haven't changed over millennia. We still have the same emotional range. We still have the same fears, desires, emotions that we have had in the past 50 years, the past 100 years, probably the past 1,000 years. In many ways, we wouldn't be where we are today So, you know, women wouldn't be where we are today unless women 100 years ago were agitating for the things we want right now. That's kind of how it works. And so I don't think it's so difficult to put yourself in someone else's shoes as long as you can be really, really mindful of the context that they're in, of the limitations that they might have had for speech and agency. All of those things are really important when you're imagining yourself into somebody else's life. And I think that's why there are often discussions about who gets to tell what stories, because you do have to be extremely careful and cognizant, I suppose, of another's context, because context is really what keeps us in our place. And that's the sort of thing that I'm trying to explore in these novels.
Well, I mean, that was why Peg felt that her life was restricted to working in the bindery and not being allowed to read the words, and also the obligations she had to her sister Maud. I mean, she wants to study at Oxford, she wants to read the books, but she's working class and she's making these books that she can't read them. There is such a painful juxtaposition, I think, for her being surrounded by the books she wants to read and the institution she wants to be a part of, but she can't have either.
I know, and I kind of think, I only thought of this metaphor after, but it's water, water everywhere and not a drop to drink. She is, as you say, surrounded by the words, the ideas, the thoughts, the poetry of people she would love to be reading. And when I say people, they're mostly men. Most of the books that she binds are books written by men, which, you know, is another sort of subtext of the story, I suppose. But she wants to be part of that. But she knows that she's been born into a different life. You know, she's working at the bindery, which is where her mother worked and where her grandmother worked, and there's an expectation she will work there until her hands are so arthritic she can't. But she wants something else. And I think, you know, history is littered with women who want something more. And it's the women who've strove to achieve that that have moved us forward, I suppose. And what I wanted, though, was more than structural barriers to keep Peggy in her place. So you mentioned gender and class in particular. I also wanted her to have the kinds of barriers that we still all have, and that's the caring responsibility. So many women listening to this and so many men listening to this would have an experience of not being able to pursue their dream because they have someone or something to care for. It could be a sibling, it could be a child or an elderly parent, it could be an animal. You know, how many of us can't kind of travel the way we want to travel because we have an animal that we can't leave at home? There are so many reasons why people don't pursue their dreams, and I really wanted to make sure that it was more than just structural things that were keeping Peggy from the things she wanted to do.
No, and you achieve that so well, and that comes through so vividly, that sense of not only having her place but having her obligations as well. So you had a sense after the Dictionary of Lost Words that there were more stories to come out of Oxford for you to write about. Are there any left, or are you done with it now, or what are you doing for your next book?
Oh, you know what? As always happens, as I was doing the research for this book, I came across other gorgeous tidbits of information which immediately sparked other stories. There is one that is percolating, but I don't think I'll write it straight away, partly because they are very research intensive. They do require travel and some kind of immersion in Oxford. And I also have, I actually have other stories I want to pursue, and I have one in particular which is much closer to home, much more contemporary, which I'm going to give a go, and I'm hoping I can pull it off.
But it sounds like you can't really get Oxford out of your bloodstream very easily.
I can't. I love it. I just adore it. And, you know, there are so many threads that are all knotted together, which I think there's still something else to be said.
Well, I look forward to whatever you produce next. Thank you so much for joining us in The Writers on Nightlife tonight.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Suzanne. It's been such a pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.